The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
In medical schools, medical students are taught that a large fraction of what they learn is going to become obsolete within a few years of their graduation.
Mathematician and author Sam Arbersman discusses his new book, The Half-Life of Facts. It's all about the shifting sands of empirical knowledge and why the only fact is that facts will definitely change. And joining us to discuss how to become a bat detective will be Chair of Ecology and Biodiversity at University College London, Professor Kate Jones. Kate will also be discussing this week's science news alongside Observer science editor Robin McKee. We'll be discussing the fungal blight that's threatening the ash trees of Britain and, great news, the British Antarctic Survey has been saved. We'll tell you all you need to know about that. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Sam Arbersman is a man who deals in facts. He doesn't, however, look at facts in quite the same way as you or I. To the US mathematician and science writer, facts are not unassailable items of knowledge. In fact, facts are by default unfixed and ambiguous. And this is the topic of his new book, The Half-Life of Facts. To find out more, I called up Sam Arbersman on a relatively good line at an unnamed hotel where he was in room 128. That's a fact. And started by asking him about what he calls a meso-fact.
So it turns out there's a large amount of knowledge that changes slowly. It might change regularly, but it changes on the order of years or decades, or on the order of a human lifetime. Unfortunately, though, we often learn these facts along with the facts that change effectively never, or very, very slowly, far slower than a single lifetime. And so we learn them, and we often then forget to update them. So when we're young, we're treated as information generalists. We learn tons and tons about all different things, so like biology, chemistry, mathematics, histories, geography. And then as we grow older, we learn more and more about less and less because we specialize. And so unless it's your area of expertise, you often don't realize that a lot of these other facts are changing around you.
So can you give me some examples of meso-facts? One thing I can think of is the number of chemical elements out there. You might have learnt on the periodic table, it's very familiar to most of us, that there are so many elements, but then actually new ones get discovered or made, you know, every few years or so. So and a lot of the latest only have been around for 10 or 20 years. So it's something surprising to people when they find out that actually the 10 or 20 of the chemical elements were only discovered in their lifetimes.
Yeah, it's a pretty surprising thing. Where on the one hand, yeah, it sounds like, 10 or 20. But if you look at the total number of elements, that can be well in excess of 10% of all. So one-tenth of all the elements might have been discovered since someone went to high school. Yeah, so there are these facts, even though they are changing regularly. And you can actually plot some curves to see how the number of elements has increased over time. But it can be very surprising because a lot of people learned the periodic table at a certain point. I can remember when taking chemistry and staring at the periodic table that was on the wall of my classroom all the time. And the truth is, since I've been doing chemistry, I don't really stare at a periodic table on a daily basis any longer. And so I probably don't realize how different it actually looks. And there are other examples. And so I mentioned dinosaurs earlier, where when we're young, we have this really clear understanding of what dinosaurs look like. And they've changed a lot. And they've changed slowly and steadily in terms of how we think dinosaurs looked. But oftentimes, you don't perceive that change in a smooth fashion. You often perceive it in sort of this abrupt fashion, where it's oftentimes you think they look like one thing until your kid comes home and says, guess what? They have feathers and look totally different. And so then it's often like only when the next generation confronts this totally different information that you realize that a lot has changed.
So you're a mathematician, and you mentioned just earlier about how you can fit some graphs to these things. Can you be quantitative about how often these sorts of facts change? Your book is called The Half-Life of Facts, which sort of gives it a sort of radioactive sort of sensibility to it. You know, half-life is where half of an element decays into something else over a certain period of time. Do facts have a half-life?
Yeah, and so the reason I use the analogy is because just like with radioactive material, you can't predict when a specific atom is going to decay, but you do know when you get a lot of them together, you know the overall shape of the decay of uranium or some other radioactive material. And I think the same thing is true with facts, at least metaphorically, and it turns out there are quantitative ways to understand this, where I can predict which specific discovery is going to occur, or what paper is going to be published, or even which bit of scientific knowledge is going to be overturned. But when you get lots and lots of facts together, a whole bunch of scientific knowledge together, then you actually discover their regularities. So, for example, in terms of understanding how knowledge becomes overturned, this team of scientists, this is about a decade ago, they were interested in understanding how knowledge in two medical fields becomes overturned. In this case, they were looking at hepatitis and cirrhosis. So these are both related to diseases of the liver. So they gave a set of papers from a span of 50 years to a panel of experts. And they said, which of these are true and which ones have been overturned or otherwise rendered obsolete? And then what they were able to do from that information is actually plot a curve of the decay. And then from that, you can read off how long it takes for half of the knowledge in these fields to become overturned. And in their case, they found it was 45 years. And there are other ways to do this as well. It's time-consuming to do that sort of analysis for lots and lots of different fields. So a lot of people use citation, so references from one paper to another, as a proxy for this. So when a field, the rate at which a field stops accruing citations or the rate of decay of citations of specific papers can be used to see how long a paper is sort of part of the current scientific conversation, and when it stops accruing references, then we realize it's become obsolete. And of course, there are other ways to think about this, but you can do that, and then you can actually fairly easily compare different fields and see the rate at which their knowledge becomes overturned.
So what's the fastest changing at the moment?
So, well, it depends how you measure it. Oftentimes, and I know within the social sciences, and actually to medicine especially, in medical schools, medical students are taught that a large fraction of what they learn is going to become obsolete within a few years of their graduation. So I would say medicine is one of the most fast-moving fields, and this is the reason that they have continuing medical education. There are websites to make sure that you have the most up-to-date reference material. So I think medicine is one of the fast-moving ones. There are certain fields within the social sciences where there's a lot of noise in terms of how data is collected and how experimentation is done. And so when there's a lot of noise, there's often a chance that the effects you're finding are not actually there. They're sometimes just due to chance. So I would say social sciences, medicine are probably on the faster moving end. On the other extreme, you have things like mathematics, where you prove a theorem, and unless you made a mistake, that will stand the test of time.
Yeah, and I mean, so I guess that's the point of a theorem in mathematics. It's there forever.
Yes. Yeah. So in that sense, I would say mathematics is probably the opposite extreme of decay.
It's probably familiar. Most scientists are probably familiar with the idea that things are evolving and changing, and as more data comes along, you change your mind, or at least ideally that's what scientists should be thinking. It might be a surprise to those people who aren't familiar with the scientific method, but what are use of the ideas in your book to those people who aren't familiar with science and the way that it works? The idea that facts change might sort of worry a lot of people, so what's your message to them?
My message is, I think intuitively a lot of people know that scientific knowledge is changing, or knowledge is changing in general.
And that's where confusion comes from, actually, for big issues.
Right. Yeah. Well, so the hope of my book is to say, okay, beneath all of this, beneath all the flux, there actually are regularities to how knowledge grows, how it becomes overturned, how it spreads from person to person. But also at the same time, along the way, we are constantly approaching a true understanding of the world around us. And so even though there is a lot of change and flux in what we know, And scientists always say that science is always in a draft form. It's never totally complete. The idea, though, is we are constantly getting closer, and I think we need to often distinguish between the core of what we know versus the frontier. And so the frontier are all the papers that are being published right now, and those are the papers that are in the news because they're new. But when those papers then become overturned by some other new bit of information, a lot of people say, oh, therefore it means we don't really know. We don't know anything. We're just constantly overturning one thing after another. And the problem is, though, at the frontier, that's really where all the excitement is happening. But it's often where we know the least, but it's really exhilarating. And so I think we often need to distinguish between what we really have a good handle on. So if I write an equation down for describing the arc a baseball makes when I throw it in the air, we don't have to worry about that equation changing. But on the other hand, though, certain things related to whether or not one food is healthy or not, this is entirely different. And those kinds of things, at the where the effects are small and where we're still trying to work things out, then they do change. But I think far from being worrying, this is it's kind of exciting to see this kind of process. A professor of mine in grad school, he gave a lecture on a Tuesday, and then on Wednesday he read a paper that actually invalidated what he had taught on Tuesday. So he went in on Thursday, and he said, "Remember what I taught you on Tuesday? It's wrong. But if that bothers you, get out of science." And so I think among scientists, there is this idea, hopefully, that there is a great deal of excitement and exhilarating feeling in seeing how knowledge churns. But underneath all that, there are some regularities, and we are getting better at understanding the world. So it's not that one theory totally throws away the previous one. I mean, when Einstein came along with his theory of understanding gravity, that didn't mean that, therefore, everything Newton said was incorrect. Newton's theory was subsumed within Einstein's theory.
I guess you're not also saying that just because people argue about climate change that they're correct either. They're just waiting for the new facts to come along and prove their side of the story.
No, yeah, certainly. I'm sure there are some people who are waiting for that. In general, I think a healthy dose of skepticism is good, just in general understanding information. But when it becomes an unhealthy dose of skepticism, that can be harmful and detrimental.
Now, you've talked about doctors and how they need continuing education. Does that mean the rest of us also need continuing education wherever we're in the fields we're in?
Ideally. Certainly physicians, since lives are on the line, there's a little bit more of an urgency to having the most up-to-date information. But this can be true in lots of other things. So whether you work in the world of like finance or business or other areas, and there's lots of different areas where knowledge is changing. A friend of mine, he was at a dinner with a hedge fund manager who I think was reasonably well known, and he began an anecdote saying, "As we all know, there are 4 billion people on the planet," and which is really out of date. That's it hasn't been true since the 70s, and the worrying thing. And so it was one thing for him to just tell this story at a table, but if he's making investment or financial decisions based on this kind of information, it can be it would be very, very incorrect. So I think we need to figure out how best to maintain our awareness of information. And the truth is, it's not always easy. Knowledge is growing exponentially rapidly. There's just so much out there. And one way to do this is to sometimes memorize fewer things. And if you're more willing to go online and just search for the answer, you're probably going to get more up-to-date information than the half-remembered thing you read in a magazine a decade ago.
That's interesting, because normally you hear that the internet's making us all stupid.
Yeah, people say that, and there's been some studies saying, it hurts our memories, or it's making us stupid. I certainly don't think that's entirely true, and in a certain way, it's kind of good that it's ruining our memories, because it forces us to have the most up-to-date information. And that being said, you don't want to have nothing in your head whatsoever, because that's probably pretty bad. I could even eliminate the probably. It's
welcome
bad.
To my world.
Yeah. But at the same time, but I think this concern is overblown. Having the ability to write things down, that also can probably hurt your memory. And I don't think anyone with the benefit of hindsight has found the idea of publishing or print to be a terrible idea.
Sam Arbersman's book, The Half-Life of Facts, is published by Current and available in hardback and ebook now. And if you go to his website, arbersman.net, you can, for a limited period, download the first chapter for free. Now, I'm factually correct in saying that I'm now joined by the science editor of The Observer, our sister paper, Robin McKee, and Professor Kate Jones, Chair of Ecology and Biodiversity at the University College London and Zoological Society of London. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hello.
This week, we're going to be discussing, we'll come to bats in just a second. But Robin, let's start with you. The British Antarctic Survey, there's a bit of a tale going on about this. It looked like it was under threat. What's happened to it?
Yes, they were going to merge it with the Maritime Institute in Southampton, save 10% of the cuts. When I say they, it's a Natural Environment Research Council, which had been told by the Tory government to trim its costs. So they were going to merge these two institutes. And of course, surprise, surprise, it was an absolute howls of outrage at the prospect of losing the British Antarctic Survey.
Why would it have been bad to merge these things? The scientists, I'm guessing, would still have been there doing something.
It would not have been the independent voice and the sole single clear voice of Antarctic research in this country. It has its own very nice building up in Cambridge, and it had its own voice. And of course, it's not just Antarctic's research it does, it does Arctic research. But we have a particular historical interest in the Antarctic, having so nearly got to the South Pole first and narrowly avoided that. And of course, the crucial point is that the research at the poles are now become more and more important. We shouldn't be backtracking on it. Should we be going further forward? The poles are the canaries in the cage of climate change. They're telling us that the changes that are happening to our planet are happening there first, and that's why it's so important. And that's why it's so important we have a presence there.
So the idea was that they were going to merge them, save lots of money, howls of outrage. So what happened last week?
Last week, the Science Select Committee at the House of Commons had a meeting, called in various people from the Natural Environment Research Council to say,
What the hell are you doing?
What are you doing? Called in David Willetts, asked one of his brains what he was doing. And they had a discussion. 4.5 hours later, they produced their report, which has got to be a House of Commons record, you know, a meeting and 4.5 hours later report saying, very bad idea. We think this is not a good idea at all. Change your mind. And the NERC met on Thursday, and a meeting, an announcement was supposed to be made today, but surprise, surprise, again, that was going to leak out. So they announced on Friday, oops, we're not going to merge it.
I mean, the Natural Environment Research Council is a responsible organisation. It funds a huge amount of good research in this area. So, you know, there's no doubt that they know what they're doing in terms of science. What there must have been something strange going on in their heads when they decided that this was a good idea to reverse it so quickly.
Can I offer a perspective from the... I read the announcement from NERC, and a perspective from NERC. I think they offered a call for the idea. They put it forward as an idea, and they asked for feedback. And the Parliament, from what they're saying on the website, the Parliament report was one of the feedbacks that they got. So they offered it as an idea. And I think, really, the ideas are to consolidate research in the Antarctic because it's so special. I think it might have been slightly...
I think you'll find that many Antarctic researchers, particularly members of the BAS, who did not feel that there was very much
consultation
going on, and they had made up their ideas to do that, and they were going to go ahead and make it fit. And it wasn't to merge it.
And the consultation was just a sort of preemptory exercise to sort of say, we're about to do this.
Precisely.
It might have been a PR masterstroke, because you suggest that you're going to close something down, you show everyone that everyone's really angry about it, and then that thing's saved. It's a bit like Six Music and other things like that.
Well, yes, there is. Well, of course.
That's the model, right?
The judicious leak, of course. Is. Where it came from and who did it is a different question. I don't think the head of the NERC is the one who leaked
no,
it.
No, I'm not suggesting that.
I think there's another note at the bottom of the NERC webpage which says something like, we want to consolidate research and improve research down in the Antarctic. So perhaps they're going to be putting, you know, maybe rethinking and thinking what the best way forward is, not just a cutback, but
I think in political terms and PR terms, I think, I don't know what the earth was going on in their heads, but I have a great deal of sympathy for them, because they've been charged with a reduction of 10% in their actual kind of money they receive, and a 45% reduction in the amounts of infrastructure money they receive. Now, that's a heck of a lot. And, you know, they had to look around and make some desperate kind of decisions. And I think this is what this one looks like. It looks like a bit of a desperate decision. And they're now, you know, again, to be fair to the NERC, they're now stuck. They've still got to find these cuts.
So the BAS, the British Antarctic Survey, is going to stay as it is. It's not going to...
And the Oceanographic Institute.
And the National Oceanographic Institute.
The Oceanographic Institute has had its cuts, but the BAS will still have to face some cuts in numbers of scientists.
And
perhaps about 10%.
Which will inevitably impact on the kind of research that it can do. And as you say, this kind of research is getting ever more important when it comes to climate change and all of that. And also, I mean, commercially, it's got to be important as well, because the Arctic, for we keep reading is not going to have any ice soon. People are going to start drilling down there at some point. And then the BAS and scientists there are going to be the ones who will tell us what's there and what to protect. And if you don't have those things, then Britain has no voice in that part of the world.
It's a very good point. I mean, that's all the more reason that we have a very, very strong polar research outfit going on for those very, very, very good reasons.
Well, Science Weekly thinks that the Polar Research Institute should carry on. We agree with that, don't
yes, we?
So it has our seal of approval. And if anyone at the BAS wants to send me or Robin to the Antarctic for a visit, we'd be very keen, I think.
You speak for yourself.
You don't want to go. Right, me then. Me,
I
just me.
With you.
Oh, Kate, me and Kate, we're going to go. I'll and Jason as well. Producer Jason, we all want to go. We want to record from
the one-way tickets, please.
I feel like we're straying from the point, however, of proper science. Kate, let's move on to your story. This is something much more close to home about how ash trees are under threat in the UK.
Yeah, so this ash tree dieback disease, this fungus, has been found, I think in February, actually, this year, in saplings and imported trees. And only last week it was found in the wider countryside in East Anglia. And it's caused an uproar because, the imports weren't banned, so that they were coming in from trees which were infected in Europe. And it seems like they've been infected there since 1992. So they've been infected quite a long time, and it spread quite a few countries, especially Denmark, where it's caused like 90% mortality. So there's a bit of outrage in general because they haven't been banned until this kind of story broke. Monday, the government banned imports, so it's been banned from now on. But there's still quite a lot of controversy about it, and quite a large worry that it's going to spread throughout the ash populations in the UK and destroy them, a bit like the Elms disease.
This has happened so quickly. It just the story especially just turned up out of nowhere a few days ago, and then it's now every ash tree in the country could be at risk and is about to be. I mean, Robin, ash, it's a classic British tree.
Yes, I mean, that's
heritage all over the place there.
Yes, it burns beautifully, and that's probably the last thing you're going to have to do with it. It is a problem, but what struck me, it was interesting, is that the Science Media Centre had a huge briefing on it last week, and it was quite clear the causes of it are odd. One is the amount of strange and exotic and very large plants that we now import into this country. Huge Chinese trees with thousands of litres of soil in them, and who knows what kind of bacteria is in that soil. And also the issue that was raised by several people, several scientists, is when you go for reiterated by the Environment Secretary last Friday, that when you go for a walk in a forest, you come back, you take your welly boots off and you wash them before you go for a walk anywhere else. So, and we're quarantining our own forests in this country.
That's never going to work. They're going to have to come up with a better solution than that.
Well, the alternative is what? I mean,
chop down all the ash trees.
Chop down all the ash trees.
Well, that's not going to work because
It's not just the ash trees that.
It's the fungus in the soil which is the problem.
Well, also the fact is that we've had twice as many outbreaks of deadly plant pathogens in this country in the few years of this century than we had in the whole of the last century. So this is a problem that is going through the roof. We have to do something and be careful. What a whole kind of clampdown on importing strange and exotic plants is one, but being very careful where you walk and what you do, when you finish your walk is one.
Kate, I mean, what are scientists doing to actually try and track this? Because you need to do this quickly.
This is a really interesting story. So this appeared last week, which is amazing, that a guy called, I think it was Toby Hammond at the ADAPT low carbon group at UEA, University of East Anglia, he came up with this idea to use the public to track the disease, because we don't really know what's the biggest problem. Is that where is it spreading? Where do we need to act? We don't know. So he came up with the idea for an app that could help help get information from the general public. So this crowdsourcing citizen science idea. So we came up with the idea on Thursday, developed it over the weekend, and released it to Android and Apple, and got special permission from Apple to release the app early because they have to go through loads of security and
checking.
This
is why scientists will rule the world one day. It's that kind of
power.
So
Apple have released it. So I think Android released it on Monday, Apple on Tuesday.
So what do you do with the app?
You download it and then you look for signs of diseased trees, ash trees, and then you can report it through the app. So I spoke to him last week and he's had 4,000 downloads on Friday.
So Kate, what is the actual app called that people can download to?
It's called Ashtag.
Ashtag.
So look on the iTunes App Store or the Android Marketplace and download it.
Apps clearly are a very interesting way of doing citizen science nowadays. I mean, if you've got an army of people and you need to collect data from around the country, it sounds like people who are interested can contribute to these sorts of science. We've talked about citizen science on the program before, and these apps are a good way of collecting data from people who are interested. And obviously, citizen science particularly is something close to your heart, Kate. And we've been talking about the fact that we're going to have bats on this program in some way for the whole show now. So let's introduce the bats, shall we? Well, not physically, but what's your new project?
Well, it really follows on from having lots and lots of people help you with projects to gather data. So we've been moaning as a biodiversity community that we don't have enough data to build our models of what's going to happen in the future. And now with all these smartphone apps and all of this new technology, we're getting more and more data in all the time. So now our problem is we've got too much data and we don't know how to analyse it properly. So we need to develop new mathematical and statistical tools to automatically understand what's in these files. So my new project is called Bat Detective, and you can go and have a look at our new website, which is batdetective.org. And we're asking the general public to log on and to see if they can find bat calls or insect calls or distinguish them from background noise in our recordings that we've got from citizen scientists all over the world who've been contributing and recording bat calls all over the world. So
do you have to train yourself to recognise a bat signal?
We have a tutorial online. So you just log in and have a go and listen to the bats, and they're really cool. And it's really fun listening to the different insects and bats that you hear ultrasonically at night.
I wonder if we can play one of the files just so that we can actually get people to train themselves now. Maybe that will be somehow skillfully inserted into this. I don't know. I can't hear anything. Mind you, I can't hear ultrasound.
Slow down, though.
Slow down, right. So it's a very interesting idea, but genuinely for you as a conservation biologist, how useful is this information? I mean, how useful are people who are maybe not trained scientists actually doing this sort of stuff?
I think you have to be really careful about what you ask them to do, and the approaches that that we've been trying to explore is asking the citizen scientist to not do any interpretation of the recording of the observation, but just to do it and then upload it, and then we can kind of process it more objectively and more scientifically.
Because if you're going to collate all this stuff together, you really do need to know that data quality is very high.
Absolutely, yeah. But these big crowdsourcing websites are a really great idea because you don't have to go out in the field. You can actually participate while you're watching EastEnders or something. Not that you would watch EastEnders.
You would watch EastEnders.
There are other programmes available to watch.
No, it's fine.
You'd be surprised what this lot watches.
Well, or while you're reading The Observer, you could just...
Absolutely.
You could there's not much to distract you.
Or listening to this podcast.
Well, I don't know about that. But I think if you're doing that, you're focused. So batdetective.org is the website, and people can learn stuff there.
So you can log on, and then people will label all these calls, and then from that we can develop an automatic classifier so that in the future we can just run that through the calls, and we can make it an online free tool so that anybody can do that with their calls.
What are some of the scientific results you hope to get from this?
We want an online free classifier which anyone can put their calls through, and also what we're working towards in the long term is an app on the smartphone. You would plug a small ultrasonic microphone that would be cheap that people would buy into the smartphone, and then it would, you would hold it up and it would tell you what species it is. So these are
amazing.
That's in my mind. Okay, so but these are all steps along the
conversation. Can you imagine? Yeah, actually, that's what we want is a bat translation device. No, but seriously, in the future, is the idea to then map the prevalence of different species of bats all over the country and to map their decline or their ascent to ruling the world or whatever it is that bats do?
So I get caught up with all of the techie excitement, but actually that is the point, to use bats as indicator species, because they're found everywhere apart from Antarctica and the Arctic, but they're good indicators of biodiversity. They have lots of key roles in the environment, like seed dispersal, insect regulation, pollination. So,
and they're wonderful animals.
And they're very cool.
Really wonderful
animals. And they're the things that you can find in the local park or the rainforest. So they're very accessible to people.
Robin, you're a bat fan. I know this.
Yeah, my favourite bat in the city is Cairns in Australia. And they've got a fruit bat colony outside the library. And fruit bats are big. They're not kind of tiny little. They're, little teddy bears with wings, and it looks fabulous. But if you walk under there at the wrong time, you can get it in the neck.
You're talking about excrement here.
Yeah, I'm talking shite. Yes, but you know that I do that all the time. And every night at sunset, all the bats fly off into the wilderness. It's a very kind of.
And also, of course, you can go bat hunting in the Houses of Parliament. I'm not talking about the MPs. And genuinely, they have a bat night, actually. Colony of bats in the sort of caverns
for the
under
MPs
there.
And other guests.
Yeah, but it's amazing. You should go, Robin.
Well, they have them at the zoo as well.
Regent's Park
has a bat night May, I think.
If you log on to Bat Conservation Trust website, there's lots and lots of things to do on there and activities and things like that.
Have you even got a little bat hospital in the zoo?
Well, I hope so.
Yes.
They're not going to look after them.
This is fantastic. This is great.
They're not going to heal themselves, but are they in the wild? Kate, Robin, thank you both very, very much indeed. You can read about all of those things at the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk/science, and of course all the Observer articles there too. And reminders of the website again for your project, Kate,
batdetective.org.
So go there and learn about some bats. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. A huge thanks to my guests, Sam Arbersman, Kate Jones and Robin McKee. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But for me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.